listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. That was the sound in the wee hours Sunday at Gerardo Barrio Square in El Salvador's capital, San Salvador, as Pope Francis announced the canonization of the late Archbishop of San Salvador, Oscar Romero, who was murdered by a right-wing death squad in March of 1980. This was Pope Francis making the announcement in Vatican City.
It's wonderful that among today's newly canonized saints, we have Archbishop Romero, who fought for people's well-being to the point of giving his life to protect the lives of those less fortunate. He always remained close to the poor and to his pilgrims.
For more on that, and first, an update on the elections a week ago Sunday in Brazil, we spoke with Tony Solo, a reporter from south of the border, via Skype, from Managua, Nicaragua, Monday.
It was quite a shock to a lot of people that the right-winger, well, the fascist, Bolsonaro,
right,
got 46% on the first round.
Yep.
But I think in a way we shouldn't have been surprised, because Bolsonaro is very much the candidate of the United States and the Brazilian elites. And they've been pulling out, they've pulled out all the stops to try and get him a win on the first round. And so in a sense, I think there's a very strong sense in which that was a victory for democracy in Brazil, that they managed to prevent Jair Bolsonaro winning on the first round.
I mean, they kneecapped the opposition, or the so-called opposition, which was actually the government until the coup there. But they first they removed Dilma Rousseff from office, the office she was elected to, and then they tell Lula, you can't run, and they throw him in jail. So, you know, they were pretty much hobbled already, and yet they were able to stop this guy, who's very charismatic, has the wall-to-wall support of the corporate media there, and except for his own, I don't know, he's got like political Tourette's. He couldn't keep his mouth shut about, gee, you know, Pinochet should have killed more people, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, and he is extremely obnoxious. And for, to give you some idea, and in his campaign addresses, when he's out stomping doing the electoral campaigning, he regularly praises the army officer who's still alive that tortured Dilma Rousseff.
Hmm.
And he's that in your face fascist.
And that guy's not in prison. I mean, that all by itself.
No. This is an army officer who's, I think he's probably retired now. Jair Bolsonaro himself is a retired army captain.
Mm. From that era, huh?
And so he's, and his base is a mixture of, I mean, he projects, it's important for people to understand that what's happening in Brazil is pretty much a rerun in some ways of what happened in Argentina in 2015. What you had in Argentina in 2015 was Mauricio Macri pretending to be an anti-system candidate. You know, how absurd is that for somebody who comes from such an established family of the Argentine, the Argentinian oligarchy? But in Macri's case, he projected himself as anti-system. He was going to bring about change, and it's something that's really fascinating to me after watching this stuff for over 30 years. And regularly, you get these right-wing parties running campaigns saying change. You know, so Macri's party was called Cambiemos, Let's Change.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they do is they project, they play on people's frustrations with the difficulties that the previous government may have had. In Argentina's case, it was the difficulties created by the international slump in commodity prices that was making the government's economic policies harder to implement to maintain living standards for the majority in Argentina. And so the right wing play on those difficulties, project that they're anti-system when in fact they're backed up to the hilt by local corporate elites and their US masters, right? So what you have in Brazil is identical to that. You've got Jair Bolsonaro projecting himself as an anti-system candidate, claiming that all the politicians are corrupt, but the most corrupt are the left-wing politicians. And so he plays on the fact that Lula da Silva is in jail, even though the majority of people in Brazil know very well that there's no case against Lula da Silva. And Bolsonaro plays on that. He plays on the need for a strong government. So strong government in it that will be able to bring about change. And because he is an evangelical Christian, he's also been able to play on the very extensive evangelical church base in Brazil that, unlike the evangelical churches elsewhere, and for example here in Nicaragua, the evangelical churches are far from right wing, right? And large sections of the evangelical church here in Nicaragua support the Sandinista government and Daniel Ortega.
Right.
But in Brazil, it's true that the great majority of the evangelicals have a right-wing agenda, to the extent that Bolsonaro is even able to say things like, well, the poor deserve to be poor because God made it that way.
Right.
You know, and so he's able to get away with these extraordinarily obnoxious statements because of the different sectors of Brazil's electorate that he's been able to play on. So then, another thing to bear in mind about Brazil is that it's a huge country and it's incredibly politically diverse.
Yeah.
And in the Congress, as a result of those elections a couple of weeks ago, the biggest party is the Workers' Party. It continues to be the Workers' Party that is the biggest party in the lower house, but that's not very helpful because there are something like 32 parties represented in the lower house of the Brazilian Congress. And so it's a Brazilian politics at that level in the lower house of the legislature is a complete lottery of who can set up the most stable coalition for the longest period of time. And that's like a complete kaleidoscope that changes constantly.
Right.
Which makes politics at that level in Brazil very unpredictable. And if you look at the electoral map of support for the different political parties in Brazil, the tendency is to see that the south and southeast of Brazil, this is a cliche, of course, but it reflects to a large extent the reality. The south and southeast of Brazil tend to support right-wing parties, and the north and northeast of Brazil, the poorer parts of Brazil, tend to support more progressive parties. And so in these elections, it was a debacle for the party of Michel Temer, the current usurper president who displaced Dilma Rousseff. That party basically collapsed, as well as a couple of other parties. The Workers' Party did really well to maintain its vote. And what was the percentage of the vote that Haddad got? Was it 29%? Something like that.
Yeah, something that, yeah.
And that,
I don't know what the
ostensibly
final was.
Ostensibly, that makes it look as though Fernando Haddad and the Workers' Party have an impossible task, because they have something like, according to those results, they have a 15-16% deficit that they've got to make up in just 3 weeks. But although on balance the probabilities are that Bolsonaro is likely to win on the second round, it's far from clear that Haddad doesn't have a good chance. And I think we'll see over the next 3 weeks. And the second round runoffs in these elections are often very different to the results in the first round, especially in a country with such a diverse and complex political composition of political parties that make up the political spectrum. So I'd say it's, although it's likely that Bolsonaro, and he'd have to be really incompetent not to be able to make up the 5% that he needs over his first round result. But people are not necessarily in control of outcomes.
That's right. And you also have the consideration of turnout again. You know, that's the thing. It's not like they, in some places where you have ranked voting, everybody that goes out to vote once, and then they just process the results twice. This is a second vote weeks later. Not everybody, right. Not the same exact people don't necessarily show up, and sometimes there can be some, you know, real variations in turnout.
Yeah, and also, I know it depends. Will Haddad be able to mobilize on the basis of the fascist threat a sufficient number of voters from the people who abstained?
Yeah, I mean, that's assuming they don't just shoot them, which is not outside the realm of possibility, the way the game's been played.
Yeah, and before the first round, the polling companies were saying that on a second round, Haddad and Bolsonaro would have a dead heat. And that sounds very like what happened back in the 2014 election when Dilma Rousseff beat Aécio Neves, who was then the right-wing candidate. She only beat him by barely 2% of the vote.
Right, it was close. I remember that.
No, and that also reflects the reality in Argentina. Macri won on a runoff with barely 2% of the vote. And so it's by no means a foregone conclusion that Bolsonaro will win outright on the second round.
Yeah,
why do we care? Why does anybody care? Because Brazil's the biggest country in South America. It's one of the. It's like the 10th biggest economy in the world. That's why people care.
It's the BRICS.
Just in political and economic terms, that's why the result is hugely important.
Right.
But because it'll again tip the balance in either in favor of or against U.S. influence in South America. So if Bolsonaro wins, the U.S. will be able to kind of get virtually everything they want in terms of the way Brazil's foreign policy gets configured. Okay. Yep. So, and if Haddad wins, they're likely to get the very opposite. Nothing that they want.
Right.
Will be taken into account by Brazilian foreign policy. Brazilian foreign policy under Haddad is likely to be extremely nationalist and extremely progressive and trying to promote a multipolar world, whereas foreign policy under Bolsonaro government will be very much an effort to collaborate as far as possible with the US corporate elites in maintaining South America as their kind of fiefdom with free access to the region's resources, both in terms of natural resources and in terms of cheap labor.
You know, when we're talking about a third of the population of South America, in essence, of 200 million roughly out of 600 million roughly in the region, and we're talking about also, for example, Brazil as one of the BRICS, when you talk about whether it's going to follow the path of multilateralism or appendage to U.S. imperialism, there's a global footprint that Brazil has in that struggle, aside from the, very potent regional one. And this is like a big prize. That's a big chair that's being fought over.
Yeah. What else is happening in the region that kind of counters that? Well, and you've got Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who's going to take the office as Mexico's president on December the 1st. And he has been making very strong noises in favor of prioritizing Mexico's domestic economy, prioritizing recovering Mexico's domestic oil production, which is currently dominated by foreign oil companies, talking about recovering Mexico's agricultural economy on behalf of small and medium-sized farmers, which happens to be one of the key areas that has enabled Nicaragua to defend itself against the recent economic attack by the United States. So, and Andrés Manuel López Obrador takes that kind of path, and that is going to be a very important counterweight to a possible Bolsonaro government in Brazil. But and another thing that has happened that's over the weekend that was very symbolic, especially for people here in Central America, about popular resistance to the kind of elite corporate attempts to claw back the influence and power and prestige and control that they've traditionally had in Latin America, which Jair Bolsonaro very much represents. Something that happened to counteract that over the weekend was the canonization of Bishop Oscar Arnulfo Romero, the Salvadoran bishop who was assassinated by the Salvadoran right wing, paid by the United States, supported by the United States, trained by the United States, armed by the United States. And they murdered Oscar Arnulfo Romero in 1980 when he was giving a speech in San Salvador's cathedral. And he was shot dead by a sniper.
Yep.
And so for years and years and years, he has been a kind of very charismatic rallying icon of the popular church and the liberation theology theologians here in Latin America call the option for the poor. And one of his most famous statements, one of Romero's most famous statements, and one that led him directly to his assassination, was that he said, "It's inconceivable that the El Salvadoran oligarchy don't recognize the need to adopt the option for the poor." No, and that was a if you look at the history of the church hierarchy in Latin America, and it was like kind of this extraordinary statement against everything that the Roman Catholic Church had stood for. In particular, in such a reactionary society as El Salvador, in a reactionary, in an area dominated by reactionary oligarchies like Central America. So that was why they had to kill him.
Yep.
And so the fact that he's now been canonized by Pope Francis.
Right, from Argentina.
From Argentina. Somebody who himself has had a controversial history in his own country in terms of his involvement or non-involvement, or there's a lot of controversy about his role during the Argentinian military dictatorship.
Right.
But the fact that that Pope from Argentina has canonized somebody totally identified with the kinds of struggles that are embodied by Lula da Silva and Fernando Haddad in Brazil, or by Cristina Kirchner and other more
That's
radical
right.
politicians in
right.
in Argentina, or Evo Morales in Bolivia, or Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua.
Especially Daniel Ortega, right.
And Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. And people forget that a lot of these leaders are very, very very, very spiritual and religious in their approach. And so the fact that Pope Francis has canonized Bishop Oscar Arnulfo Romero has transformed Romero from a left-wing martyr into a mainstream saint.
He's a saint, that's right.
So that's, you know, that's very important in cultural terms in Latin America. People in the secular societies that exist in North America and Western Europe may not appreciate that.
Yeah.
But here in Latin America, it's a very big deal.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, it's even bigger than the span that you just described, given his own personal history, because when he was appointed archbishop in early 1977, the people who were involved in liberation theology were not enthused because he hadn't really shown any mettle in that area. And
right.
he was identified as someone, you know, more or less establishment, you know, complicit, whatever. And then a month later, a friend of his, who's a Jesuit priest, was assassinated. And he said, you know, if that's what he got killed for, that's what I need to be doing. And he turned around. So he goes from being essentially right-wing lackey to liberation theological archbishop to saint. Well, to dead, and then saint. Martyr, and then saint.
Yeah, and there's something... it's impossible to know, because one can't know what goes on in the minds of these figures. But the bishop here, the cardinal here, Cardinal Obando here in Nicaragua, he was regarded as effectively a CIA agent during the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 1990s, he played quite a constructive role in reconciliation in Nicaragua, as did Daniel Ortega and some of the Contra leaders, in particular a guy called Comandante Franklin. Israel Galeano was his name, and who was assassinated for his pains trying to reconcile the Contra with the Sandinista front. And so through all that process, and Cardinal Obando came to change his mind, and he didn't adopt outright the option for the poor like Oscar Arnulfo Romero did,
right.
But he certainly became a figure who was extremely distrusted by the right-wing church hierarchy. And it was just, I thought it was really symbolic that he died right at the beginning of the attempted coup here back in April.
Yeah.
And the church hierarchy that he'd kind of kept under control, the fascist elements in the church hierarchy here, like the bishop here in Estelí, a guy called Abelardo Mata, and the bishop in Matagalpa, Rolando Alvarez, and another bishop called Silvio Páez down there in Managua. These three people are outright fascists, and they promoted the coup. And they are exactly the representatives of the church that detest figures like Oscar Arnulfo Romero, and they're the kind of church figures in the rest of Latin America, like the church hierarchy in Brazil, for example. Oh, sorry, in certainly the church hierarchy in Brazil, and to some extent, but in particular the church hierarchy in Venezuela, who are very much part of the fascist political opposition there. And the canonization of Oscar Arnulfo Romero is really a major ideological and moral setback for them. So then, I was particularly struck by the symbolism and the importance of Romero's canonization, because over the last week or so, I've been doing interviews with people in the health service here who were affected by the coup. You're talking about health workers who were threatened, health workers who were tortured by the opposition here. None of this gets reported in the international corporate media or by international human rights organizations.
Which coup are you talking about? You're talking about in Nicaragua?
Yeah, I'm talking about Nicaragua now.
Which coup?
And
now?
I did that. I'm sorry, John?
What you said, the coup. Which coup?
The coup here in Nicaragua, the attempted coup.
Oh, the attempted coup. Okay, yeah, gotcha. Back in April.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I'm people here just talk about El
the
Golpe.
Coup. I gotcha.
The coup.
Got
but what they really mean is the failure.
Well, because there's so many coups that have actually been, you know, fully actualized.
So during the attempted coup here, health workers were very much a target of the coup promoters. Now, why was that? And if you, and this take, although I'm talking, we're talking here about a very small country of only 6 million plus people here in Central America. What you're actually talking about is something that is absolutely categorically relevant for the whole continent, because what the right-wing coup had targeted was the public health system, the popular economy, everything that smacked of support for the majority, support for the impoverished majority. Why did they burn ambulances? And why is that not reported in the corporate media?
Right.
Why did they smash the windows of ambulances and kidnap and torture health workers? You know, and why did they invade hospitals and kind of get mother and child clinics and ransack them and wreck them? Why did they do that?
You know, well, these are the basis of both the political power of the Sandinistas and really the political power of the people. When the right says, why aren't you voting for us? They say, because we have health care. Boom. No, you don't. Because we have housing. Boom. No, you don't. Because we have access to food and education. Boom. No, you don't. They keep trying to destroy the public infrastructure that gets built up when the people have control of the government, so that they can make the people essentially feel like they did all this work for nothing, because they have nothing at the end of the day again.
Right. And so in these interviews that I did with people in the health service here over the last few days, I was repeatedly struck by the extraordinarily moral commitment of people at grassroots, you know. And you're talking about ambulance drivers who would have to negotiate roadblocks, every one of which they were threatened.
Mm.
Now, how many people would do that? And what possesses ordinary people to show that kind of moral resilience, you know, against fascist threats? Yeah. And it's what you were just talking about. They know they're defending something that belongs to them.
That's right. They
and that is for the benefit of them and their families. And that's where you get that extraordinary moral resilience from.
Right, that's right.
And that explains, in a very profound way, the link that ordinary people at grassroots feel to figures like Oscar Arnulfo Romero.
Right, that's right. You know, there's also, if you think about the role of religion in Marxist politics as it's evolved over the last century and a half, and the struggle in places like Latin America. You mentioned earlier, for example, you know, we've had this right-wing Catholic Church for so long, and a struggle, the rise of liberation theology, the smothering of it with the Polish Pope, etc. the alternatives that arise. Suddenly, some of the evangelicals take on a progressive political, and they get involved in the political struggle. And so the left is engaged in a battle for the hearts and minds of religious peoples. And so when you suddenly canonize Romero in that context, that's like, you know, a checkmate on a one major game in a series of chess games.
Yeah, and I think that's a good summary of why Romero's canonization has not just a significance for people in El Salvador, people in Central America, but I mean, he has a continental significance.
Yeah.
That he might perhaps not have had before.
Yep. You know, it makes me wonder also what kind of moves he's making, if any, in Africa and Asia.
Right. Yeah. I'm not up on the church in Africa.
Nor am I. I think it's something I'll look into that maybe we could talk about another time. We've got about 2 minutes left. Not even.
Well,
a minute and a half.
There is something that I feel very strongly about that we talked about before we began our conversation, before we began recording, and that is that, and if you look at, and going back to this whole issue of human rights, and why is the reality of what happened in Nicaragua and the reality of what's happened in Venezuela and the decades-long reality of Cuba, why is that reality not fairly reported in, or reported at all, in the corporate media? And why is it so distorted by international human rights organizations like the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights or the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, for example? And the fundamental reason, it seems to me, is that it's the same, in the same way that international financial organizations like the World Bank and the IMF are supposed to be aimed at reducing poverty. Of course they're not. Their agenda is dictated by Western corporate elites. And the same, because they have a neoliberal economic agenda. And all these human rights organizations, from Amnesty to Human Rights Watch to
all of them,
these organizations have a neoliberal interpretation of human rights, which is designed to suppress the rights of the impoverished majorities around the world and promote the agenda of the Western corporate elites.
That's exactly right.
I think it's
right.
really important to understand that.
That's right. Tony, thank you very much. We'll speak again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Good to talk to you.
The same. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. There was never any love lost between the Soviet Union or Russia on one hand and NATO on another. But over the last couple of years, their animosity has once again transformed into the main policy determinant for both. Will the bloc mentality ever stop blocking relations in larger Europe? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Stefano Pilotto, professor at the Trieste University in Italy. Professor, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time. We are recording this interview right after your public talk about how the Western containment policy against the Soviet Union has now been replaced by Russia's efforts to contain NATO. And I wonder if, in the case of Russia, it's really containment as much as, let's say, the effort to simply keep NATO away.
Good. First of all, it's interesting from the historical point of view to see how this word containment was exploited right after the Second World War by the United States to urge the need to contain the potential expansion of the Soviet Union towards the eastern side of Europe. And at that moment, containment became more or less one of the pillars of the foreign policy of the United States, and NATO was one of the tools of the containment, not the only one, but in Europe, NATO was for sure the most important tool to try to contain the Soviet Union.
Do you think Russia is doing the same to NATO now? Because as you pointed out, I think the Russian policy is much less multi-layered than what you described.
I think that in one sense, Russia was waiting to see how far NATO could go, how much NATO could make ingerence in the former Soviet republics, because we had the explosion of Soviet Union and many new independent countries. But there remain, in my opinion, what the French called le domaine réservé, which means a privileged area of interaction between the former Soviet Republic. We may understand that, for instance, in some of the countries, such as in the Baltic states, there was not always a huge friendship between some part of those population
and Russia. But there were also natural economic ties that sustained not only Russia, but I understand many in the Baltic states.
Correct. Not only economic ties, but also a common, very often, way of thinking, a common way of having mutual relations. That is because of the history. And even though the Baltic states, they can, of course, consider that in the past there were other troubles, they were independent between the two world wars, and then they were included in the Soviet Union at the beginning of the Second World War, but not with other former Soviet republics, such as Ukraine or Georgia. Well, mainly Ukraine. Ukraine and Russia, they have common history, they have common, I would say, cultural and religious values.
Let's discuss those in details, but let me press you once more. Do you think Russia's current policy vis-a-vis NATO could really be described as containment?
I do consider that what happened in the very recent months shows that Russia, on one side, is turning toward Asia in order to create a stronger Asian bloc.
And it would against the West?
Yeah, and that would be a first step to stop the enlargement of the Western countries toward Russian Federation. Secondly, the new generation of weapons. This year, the president of Russia Federation, during the speech in the beginning of March, he showed new weapons. And that means that the more NATO is acting in order to establish new military bases in Central and Eastern Europe, or the more the United States are looking forward the new system of anti-ballistic missiles and so on, the more this has no sense.
But look, as far as I understand, from the Russian point of view, there is a big difference between containment as an effort to contain, to limit the spread of NATO, not only in the Russian neighborhood, but around the world, and pure defense and trying to keep NATO at bay. Russia sees the main difference between those two actions. But from what you're saying, it looks like you believe Russia is actually trying to deal with NATO as
you,
a global
in concrete way, what is containment? Containment is now Crimea and Donbass on one side, South Ossetia and Abkhazia on the other side. This is a very concrete step and action in order to stop, to warn the others to step forward. This is a very concrete, and those are military action and political action, of course. Now, we were discussing a lot about the further potential step of NATO in Europe, which could be the one of the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. Last year, Montenegro joined, and we had big troubles in Montenegro, huge discussion, even the news concerning Milo Djukanovic and the potential attempt to the life of Milo Djukanovic because he was in favor to join NATO. What does it mean today to join? NATO. To join NATO means for some countries this is an insurance policy, but on the other side, be part of NATO means to have some benefits. Do we have economic benefits, financial benefits, also the fact that the country can rent some bases to the United States? They will pay for this.
The Western policy during the Cold War was based on the notion of ideological incompatibility with the Soviet Union. There was a strong ideological factor there. Do you think Russia ideologically also sees itself at odds with the West?
No. I think that there is a different approach to life. There is different culture. What is Russia nowadays? Is Russia a democracy as we may consider any other Western European country? Probably not. In Russia, there is a special democracy, let's call it like this. Very often, my opinion is that the Western European countries and NATO countries, they tend to emphasize the danger that Russia represents in order to create an enemy that would justify new further actions toward that kind of enemy. If somebody knows Russia, are we sure that Russia would like to invade Estonia, Latvia, or Lithuania? I personally don't think so. Are we sure that Russia wanted to include Crimea if there was not a coup in Ukraine in 2014 that was allowed even by European countries and the European Union? This is the problem. The problem is that sometimes we also have interference from the Western countries in the internal affair of the former Soviet republics. And this is because the strategy of NATO and of the Western countries is to grow, to include more countries in their group in order to have more probably economic profit and benefits.
You mentioned the crisis in Ukraine. I think we both will agree that it was precipitated by this very tenuous relationship between Russia on one hand and NATO on another hand. Both sides still blame one another for what happened. But do you think internally, at least, has there been any reevaluation of what happened in Ukraine, why it happened, and what are the potential consequences?
This is what we try to discuss, because in my opinion, what is very interesting is what provoked the crisis of Ukraine. Mainly, there was a movement in Ukraine. There was a movement at the beginning of the new millennium. It was the Orange Revolution, a movement leading the country towards the West. But then there was, when Yanukovych was elected again, there was a new position of the majority of the Ukrainians. But then my opinion is that the European Union had a wrong behavior. The European Union is an international organization. It should be a neutral international organization.
Well, it's hard to be neutral when you fear your neighbor, One interesting thing you said was that European Union was on the path for many years. The European Union was on the path of enlargement. But just last March, the European Commission issued a white paper in which it described five possible scenarios for its future. And none of them mentioned either the integration of Ukraine or the EU enlargement in general. Do you think that has crystallized over the last 4 years, or do you think even before the Maidan events that was more or less understood, and the European officials who were very active during the Maidan protest in encouraging the pro-European sentiment were essentially misleading the Ukrainians in that?
To be honest, but I don't have evidence of this. It would be nice to study on the diplomatic papers when we will have access to this. I think that there is a strong synergy very often between the European Union and NATO. In NATO, we have the preeminent role of the United States of America. And the United States, they have the capability to make pressure on the other members of NATO in order to go in a direction. And when I talk about the European Union, I talk about the kind of propaganda that the European Union did in Ukraine through the higher representative for a foreign policy, which was Lady Catherine Ashton, when she went to Maidan Square with the European flag to promote the European Union. But that was, in my opinion, a wrong behavior, because the European Union should say to any candidate members, we do not close the doors if the countries respect the prerequisites, but we will not make ingerence in the internal affair of a country in order to promote European Union and to seduce the country towards the European Union.
Especially when you have no intention of following up on that and actually accepting the country into the European Union. Ukraine is now facing presidential elections, and the political tensions in that country are pretty strong. There are five declared candidates, more than a dozen of possible candidates. The incumbent president has a somewhat low rating. If there is a political crisis, another political crisis in Ukraine, say in 2019, do you think the European Union would be just as eager to interfere in and take sides?
As you know, today there is a big competition in the field of communications. How do you communicate? How do you make interference? You have a lot of chances to do that. I think that the European Union should a bit slow down its presence in this framework and should leave the country to decide. So democracy also means that the country should be free to take the best possible solution, but at an internal level. There shouldn't be a lot of interference from outside, but very often we do have this.
But do you know very well that some Ukrainian politicians, for example, would want the European Union to interfere actively and to, you know, essentially endorse their political candidacy?
Let's wonder, what does it mean to be part of the European Union? It means, for many countries, means, oh, this is a good opportunity.
It means good living standards, I think,
exactly,
for the majority of the people.
This is a good opportunity to become a bit richer, because we will get some money from the European Union. So it's a good opportunity. But what does it mean from the moral point of view? That means to share the European values. I'm not that sure that in all the European member states there is the same European spirit, the same European culture.
Well, the Ukrainians definitely claim that they have that European spirit. In fact, they believe that they are at the forefront of defending the European values.
I remember the sentence of Viktor Yanukovych some years ago when he said, we are a European country, but we have special relations with Russia. But when he said we are a European country, means where is Ukraine? Ukraine is in Europe. If we consider that Europe goes from the Atlantic Ocean to the Ural Mountains, Ukraine is
new. Well, so is Russia then.
So part of Russia is there. But can we include part of Russia in the European Union? Or does Russia wish to be part of the European Union? We are quite skeptical in front of this option. The problem is that when we seduce a new member in the European Union, we should also think about the consequence of this in the bilateral relation of that country with the previous friends and partners such as Russia and Ukraine.
Well, too late for that, I guess. Professor Pilota, we have to take a short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Stefano Pilato, professor at Trieste University in Italy. Professor Pilato, speaking more broadly about transatlantic solidarity, I think nothing tests friendships more effectively than bickering about money. And President Trump seems to be very unequivocal about Europe having to pay more to the NATO budget. Do you think he's going to get what he wants from Europe?
I'm not that sure. Because of the economic crisis, I take, for instance, the example of my country, Italy. Italy spends less than 2% of the GDP for the defense. President Trump was asking that very clearly. And it's absolutely understandable, because there should be the principle of burden sharing. And, of course, we do not have the same financial capability. The United States are the most important country, the most important GDP of the world. But there is a percent. So, in general, I think you should at least attain 2% of your GDP to the defense. Now, we are facing a huge crisis. In Italy, they are discussing in these days the new financial law. Moreover, the new forces that are in the government, they promised to deliver some resources to the poor people. We call that reddito di cittadinanza. And they are now trying to find resources in order to maintain what they declare during the campaign, because this is coherence, of course. But mathematics is mathematics, and very often figures are figures, and it's not easy to find this compared to the available resources.
Now, speaking about mathematics, I learned recently, to my own surprise, that Italy's real per capita GDP is now lower than the when the Eurozone experiment began in 1998. Even Greece has actually registered some growth, but Italy hasn't. When those supposedly populist politicians say that Euro hasn't delivered for Italy, don't they actually have a point?
That's why they won the last elections. Yes, they have a point. The people feel to be poorer concerning the purchase power. But the problem is that in the last years we were affected by a huge world economic financial crisis, and we had also to put that in with comparison with the European crisis that we had after 2005, when the European Constitution was rejected. Then we had the huge crisis in the Eurozone. Now we do not really have a lot of resources to deliver to the defense, to the military, as we may say. And very often the Italians during the period of the Cold War, they were thinking that there is no need to invest a lot of money in defense, because in any case we will be protected by the United States and by NATO. But this is exactly what the Americans now they reject and say, you cannot continue to survive like this. And they have a point also in this.
Now, sometimes the current Italian government is actually compared to the Trump administration in terms of at least their flamboyancy. And I heard some European politicians or European bureaucrats to express the same sentiment that, you know, we should just wait them out as we hope to wait out Trump. Do you think that is a sustainable approach? Do you think that those kind of political forces are temporary or more permanent?
To be honest, I'm not a politician and I don't support this government or another government. I'm just an historian, so I just try to see things from an objective point of view. Even the word populism sometimes is a wrong word, in my opinion. We have new political movements in Europe we have to respect from the democratic point of view. Well, it's not really correct just to define this movement as a populist, which means populist very often means extremist. No, because this movement, they have success also because they represent the will of the population to protest in front of some true problems that we have. We will have next year elections in the European framework. We will see which will be the result of the so-called populist movement in the European Parliament, and then we will consider that as an indicator of the problems that the Europeans have nowadays.
You mentioned some real problems, and I think the two main factors that may have influenced the Italian electorate are immigration and the economy, and on both of which decision making was mostly done in other European capitals rather than Rome. Much of that was done in Brussels, some of that was done in Berlin. Do you think the change within the Italian politics is dramatic enough to encourage some change in the decision-making on the European level with regards to both immigration and the management of economy?
This is partly true. The problem for Rome is to obtain to be respected by the others. The problem of immigration was another interesting indicator, because Rome was left very often alone to manage this problem instead of having the necessary support from the other European partners. So when I was mentioning before, what is the European spirit? The European spirit means also a common solidarity in Europe. If we are together, if we decided to be together, then we should show this solidarity, and there should be the same principle of burden sharing that we were mentioning in NATO context. So burden sharing means that if we have a problem of immigration in Sicily, in Lampedusa, in southern Italy, or in Greece, even Denmark, even Sweden, even Finland,
or maybe even Poland,
they should cooperate to this and not just say this is not our problem because this is very far from our borders. It depends on also the skills of the politicians. You know, now we have a new generation of politicians. Not everybody is convinced about the fact that they are very well prepared to face the challenge. Maybe yes, maybe no. We will see.
Can I ask you specifically on Italy's prospect of exiting the EU? Because later this month, the European Commission may take an unprecedented decision of rejecting Italy's national budget if the government does not improve its deficit figures. And it's an interesting conundrum, I think, for the European Commission, because on the one hand, it doesn't want to set a, you know, a bad example for others. But on the other hand, if it defies the Italian government, it may actually increase the prospect of them taking that step and leading the country out of the Eurozone. What do you think would be less damaging, both for the EU and for Italy?
Very good question. First point, going out not from the EU, but from the Eurozone.
Eurozone, exactly, yes.
Eurozone, okay, that doesn't mean that the country would leave the European Union.
Even though that mechanism of separating the two has not been determined
yet. In any case, I think that it's almost impossible that Italy would leave the Eurozone. What is possible is to have a new conflict between the European Union and the Italian government on the decision that the government will take concerning the financial forecast and the financial budget. The new government must maintain the promises that they had with the voters. They are extremely squeezed between the need to respect the European parameters and the need to improve the situation of the Italian population as a whole. What does it mean to improve the situation of the Italian population? Very often means to create new opportunities for citizens living also,
for instance, in different regions. Which requires money and which would mean budget deficit.
Yes. I think that the European Commission may make a pressure on Rome on this. They are doing that. What is not acceptable from the principal point of view is that the European Union should say what the government should do or not do.
Well, there is another European country that is facing not the same but somewhat similar dilemma about principles. I'm talking about Poland, which is in a pretty frayed relationship with the European Commission and the European Union as a whole. How far do you think both Warsaw and Brussels are willing to take that dispute over principles?
Well, this is part of democracy. I mean, sometimes we have different opinions. We must respect each other. What is dangerous is to say now you are not allowed to be part of the European Union anymore if you don't share the same principle. This is, of course, is a fundamental aspect. But you have to understand how do they interpret this in the local level. So there should be also a bit of flexibility in the European Union. Maybe not too much flexibility, but a bit of flexibility. And sometimes we have different cultures in Brussels. We have the north culture, which is quite rigid, and the southern part of Europe culture, which is more flexible.
And the Polish would be somewhere in the middle, you suppose?
Now the Polish are living in a very interesting moment because they also have their own culture. Just consider that Poland was for many years a socialist country, but also it was probably the only socialist country who had a very deep Christian Catholic feeling and religion. And this mixed is very strange because it could be considered as a paradox, as an incoherence. Now it comes out and they want to strengthen their own specific Polish identity. And they are ready also to fight against the European Union and to send to the European Union some messages.
I sometimes hear the Poles say that the Brussels elite do not really practice what they preach. They say it's about principles, but they themselves not always live up to those principles. And I think that's very similar to how Russians frame their disagreements with Europe before the Ukrainian crisis, which makes me wonder if the European Union will have to redefine how it sees itself and how it defines its principles in the face of both this external tensions and this internal defense that we see from Poland and to some extent from Italy.
Yes, European Union is now in a very interesting stage in a sense that the governance of European Union becomes more and more difficult because the more the European Union is enlarging itself, the more we have more and more member and it's more and more difficult to find, I would say, synergy inside of the European Union. Brexit would be a big defeat of the European Union in any case. Starting to have countries that are leaving the European Union, not the Eurozone, the European Union, that could represent an aspect that could be followed by other countries in the future if they are not happy about the policy of the European Union. So for the next elections next year of the European Parliament, the bodies of the European Union, they should seriously reconsider their approach to the international relations inside of European countries, and which could be the part of flexibility that they can admit in order to avoid the explosion of the European Union.
Well, Professor Pilato, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your being with us today, and thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you to you.
I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages, and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.